This is Talk is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, this week is the Beehive Collective. This is from their website at beehivecollective.org. The Beehive Design Collective is a wildly motivated, all-volunteer activist arts collective dedicated to cross-pollinating the grassroots by creating collaborative anti-copyright images for use as educational and organizing tools. We work as word-to-image translators of complex global stories shared with us through conversations with affected communities. All right, so this was recorded back in September of 2024, September, October. But I had, there was a bunch of wild and wacky stuff that I played before that was a little more timely, and I'll have more wacky, zany stuff for you in the future, including some stuff from the January 20th and 19th demonstrations. So I hope you'll keep listening to Talk is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Please support independent radio. Please support independent media. And check out the comedy open mics in your town.
Hi, I'm Dee. I'm with the Beehive Collective. And before I get started, I just kind of want to like gauge the audience to just see who's all here, because we've been kind of quiet as a collective for a little while. And so we found in the last like year of touring, there's a lot of new people who haven't seen our work before, who are coming out and seeing it for the first time. So as a collective, we've been around for about 25 years. Really like took off during the anti-globalization era. Was anyone around back then fighting the good fight against corporate globalization? A few of y'all. The first few posters that came out were pretty self-explanatory, but that all changed when we created the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Has anyone seen this one before?
Yeah.
A few of y'all. So this one was made at the behest of organizers in Quebec City who were planning this massive demonstration to fight against the Free Trade Area of the Americas. The FTAA was basically going to be like NAFTA, but for the whole hemisphere, Canada all the way to Chile. And we set out to make a poster to like hype up folks to come out and shut down that meeting. But as you'll see, it says Swarm Miami, and that's because we didn't get it done on time for the protests in Quebec City. Luckily, other artists stepped in and filled that void, and there was some cool art that was made for that one. We got this poster done right after the large protests in Quebec City against the FTAA, and then used it as both an organizing, education, and fundraising tool to mobilize people for the Miami summit. And so we printed off thousands of these and sent them all across the U.S., and had local organizers use this to educate people in their community about how this free trade zone was gonna harm so many different communities. And then sold prints of these to send people to the protests in Miami. And people swarmed Miami. We shut that down. That was the last time this free trade zone ever met. It died. It died in Miami. This free trade zone never came to pass. And so if you look, what you're looking at is, in the middle, we have these three mechanical spiders representing three forces of corporate globalization. You have the military-industrial complex down on the bottom right, or I guess lower left, bottom left. At the top there, we have the spider of industrial development, and on this side here, the spider of media technology. And they're weaving this web, and all the different animals that are getting caught in the web are representing different communities that are being harmed by corporate globalization. Along the bottom, we have these ants. We call them the resistance. And they are engaged in all kinds of different tactics that you would see at these large demonstrations. They've got bolt cutters, they've got spray paint, they've got puppets, they've got pies, they've got banners, they're doing music, they're unplugging electricity to the meetings. And so it's a big shout out to these mass demonstrations that were taking place all across the world, as people were fighting for a different future. And so we were touring with this for a while, even after the FTA was dead. We toured with this to talk about corporate globalization, and we got some constructive criticism, right? Especially from folks in the Global South, about how, resistance is a lot more than showing up to protests, right? And we have the resistance down there, but it's pretty like singularly focused on these mass mobilizations in terms of what we're depicting. So we really took that critique to heart, And from that point on, we only made art after going on listening tours of the regions most impacted by an issue. You have it hanging on the door?
Yeah.
Nice. This is like our most widely distributed piece. We printed 250,000 copies of this and distributed it all across the US, Canada, Mexico, obviously throughout Colombia, and around the world. There was a time where you probably couldn't have found like an activist space or a punk house that didn't have one of these, maybe in the mid-2000s. And so this was inspired by, the drug war, right? Talking about the US military aid to Colombia, talking about the movements of solidarity with Colombia at the time. We have members of our collective that are from Colombia, and so this has been doing the rounds throughout Colombia for the last two decades, being used as popular education. And so it started with a listening tour, and right away people said, hey, we can't just start talking about the drug war. We have to talk about, you know, the history. We have to talk about colonialism. And so, you know, this new kind of military aid and foreign intervention and drug war stuff flows out of like a U.S. neo-colonization that flows out of European colonization. So that's how we start this off, as a scroll at the top. We have the wasp nest in the shape of Europe. You know, like wasps, like white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. But it's not just the Protestants. We got the Pope wasp there too, or if you know, Catholics got to be represented up in there. And in nature, when a wasp nest is depleted of resources, often a new wasp nest comes out of the base of that. And so here we have the new colonialism of the United States. Below that, the winged terror, right? The spy and sonar technology, the bombers, the Black Hawk helicopters. And this is talking about military aid, right? Military aid is a big issue right now, right? People are talking a lot about U.S. military aid. And obviously there's a movement to cut off U.S. military aid to Israel, and we need that to be successful. It's more important than it ever has been. But it's not the first time that we've had movements to cut off U.S. military aid. The U.S. has been providing military aid to all kinds of terrible countries for decades and decades and decades that are engaged in genocides, that are engaged in civil wars, that are violating human rights. And so there was a movement in, to cut off military aid to Colombia at that time. Now, we didn't want to just talk about it with this like very like dark, like violent perspective. So we also have the resistance making their return and their leaf cutter ants, and they're cutting away at this nightmare layer to reveal the beauty below, right? So you have like this winged biodiversity kind of breaking free as the ants cut them loose in this nightmare layer here. As we travel down, we start to see the spraying of the rainforest.
Are we gonna hold it?
Yeah, that's good, thank you. All right, so you start to see the spraying of the rainforest with the Plains, DynCorp, and Monsanto, these corporations that got contracts to defoliate regions in order for these, you know, military planes to more accurately target the guerrillas in the jungles of Colombia. And they sprayed it from so high because they didn't want to get shot down by the guerrillas, which meant that, you know, vast regions of Colombia were poisoned. And not only Colombia, we had to actually travel through into Ecuador too, because the toxic drift spread into Ecuador. On a listening tour, you heard from farmers and indigenous peoples who had, you know, been sprayed as well. Below that, you can see the extraction that this is all facilitating, these mechanical mosquitoes that are sucking out all the oil. And towards the bottom, the leafcutter ants have made their biggest cut, right through the heart. One side of the heart is the heart of empires, the heart of the oil economy and the military-industrial complex and this authoritarian capitalist system. And the other side is earth-based cultures and cyclical time. And at the very bottom, the words Plan Colombia are spelled out with scorched earth and pipeline font, and the resistance are literally dismantling the pipelines. Talking about the necessity of dismantling this whole concept and notion of these nation states. And it's a reminder that nation states are relics of colonialism, all of them, right? All nation states in the world are arbitrary borders that have been drawn across diverse peoples, cutting certain people off from others who should be, you know, in community, and also forcing people that maybe need to have space from each other into the same political, borders. And, Colombia, right? It's a nation that's named after the world's most infamous colonizer, Christopher Columbus, right? So this piece has been, used as an education tool in Colombia for a couple decades now. Members of our collective are still down there. And there's been a pretty big shift. Like when this first came out, there was union leaders going missing, and like environmental defenders and indigenous peoples going missing, and you know, there was a very right-wing government. This civil war was still raging. Last year, this was actually in the National Gallery of Colombia. And the current vice president has this in their office. So like, there's been a pretty big shift politically in Colombia in recent years. And so what was once kind of dangerous to talk about and to make art about has now become like normalized and accepted, which is pretty cool. All right, so that's just a little bit about our history. I want to talk about this piece. So what you're looking at here is called The True Cost of Coal. It took 3 years to create. 10 people in our collective worked on it. And it was inspired by resistance to mountaintop removal coal mining. And there's a member of our collective that's, you know, from Appalachia, that's rooted there, and that was organizing with this campaign called Mountain Justice Summer. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of that, but it was this campaign to bring people from across the U.S. to Appalachia to support communities defending their mountains from this very destructive form of extraction. And so a team of bees kind of coalesced around that member and went to work creating this piece, starting with a listening tour, talking to people that work in the coal industry, environmentalists, indigenous peoples, youth, academics and historians, never any people who've just been impacted in some way by coal. And, you know, over and over again, we were told we can't just talk about mountaintop removal coal mining. There's so many important histories in Appalachia. We have to understand our histories to understand our present. And not only that, right? Like, we should understand our histories. We should, you know, be fighting in the present day. We should also be envisioning. We should be, like, you know, projecting into the future, right? So with every story we tell, with every plan we make, we should be thinking for many generations to come. And so that's why this piece is a winding timeline, right? From a pre-colonial past over on this side, even going back, you know, millions of years ago into the creation of coal in the marshlands of Appalachia with these horsetails and these ferns and other plants that got compressed at a time when anaerobic bacteria didn't exist, right? So when you burn coal, you're burning, you know, tens of thousands of years of photosynthesis in an instant. As you travel up the graphic, you start to see the lives of the original peoples, the Cherokee in this case, and then the onset of both settling and migration, as well as the violence of settler colonialism and empire building. You have the rolling out of the railroads, the nation-building industries, the company towns where people were paid in coupons and, you know, were kind of trapped there in this form of indentured servitude. The worker rebellions and uprisings that gave birth to unions, right? And the celebrations and victories that came from that struggle represented down here. Then we move through the mechanization of industries to get to the present day reality of climate chaos, consumerism, mass incarceration, economic and community displacement, cycles of addiction and poverty, extreme energy extraction, and environmental disasters. Then we travel through resistance, all the ways communities are standing up and fighting for their rights, for their air, for their water, for their land, for their futures, right, and for each other. And through all these diverse tactics, we get to a hopeful, sustainable, and regenerative future on this side of the graphic here. Right? So what's past the future. Along the bottom, we have stories of individuals, then groups of people, communities, society, and at the very top is the big economic and political issues of the era. So you can kind of look at it as a grid, right? Past the future, micro to macro. And so with that, I want to give y'all like a couple minutes to kind of get up, get real close, find your animal, find your scene. You know, maybe there's a machine, maybe there's an insect, maybe there's a plant, but I want you to pick some element of this, and I want you to kind of try to interpret a little bit on your own, and maybe then share your interpretation for everyone in the room.
Even though you know, the signs have also been shot up. Who else wants to come just quickly tell the detail? What you're seeing, what you're interpreting?
Is that raptor right there, like delivering a scroll?
Over here?
I don't know if it's a scroll, but...
Yeah, it's like the youth coming home, right? So kind of being welcomed home, bringing healthcare, bringing, you know, like their full selves. A lot of people left Appalachia because it's a very conservative place culturally. So, you know, kind of like queerness coming back into the region, people asserting themselves in that way.
Yeah,
It kind of ties to some other scenes. So when we went on our listening tour, one of the biggest things that people kept bringing up was that there's a lot of youth flight from the region, right? A lot of people are off, going off to other regions to chase dreams, and you know, it's leaving a lot of communities feeling that there's no future, because a town without youth has no future, right? So it's kind of like projecting into the future, this like this return of youth. Yeah.
This was done like over 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
It's still so relevant.
Sorry, you had your hand up too.
Yeah, I was interested in these birds. I saw them before, and at first I thought, you know, maybe the birds in the cages were representative of like a chain game on the way to something, but you said that it has more to do with colonization, so...
So the top is the big like economic and political issues of the era.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot to do with colonization here with the birds.
I saw, like, there seems to be, you know, over here you've got like a bunch of birds that are obviously kind of antagonizing these families over here, and they seem like the same kinds of birds up there.
Does anybody know what kind of birds these are?
They look like crows, but are they?
They're not passenger pigeons.
Starlings.
Yeah, that's what
you're talking about.
Oh.
Yeah. And so, we drew the starling as this nature metaphor for colonization. Do y'all know why?
Because they kill other birds.
They kill other birds. They're very aggressive. They're known for pushing other birds out of their nests. They're invasive. They're from Europe. And so here you can see they're intentionally spreading disease with a smallpox blanket, pushing the birds' nests out of the tree. And this one with the kind of Bibles and the crucifix is also trying to steal the young out of the nest, talking about boarding schools, residential schools, storing stolen generations. The native mama bird is smacking them, being like, get your hands off my kids. Mm-hmm. Now, here, they're bringing these other birds in cages. So now what do you think that might be representative of?
Slavery.
Yeah, so these are African birds in these cages. And you can see there's many other kind of chained up, chains of cages behind them in the distance as well. Kind of one of the biggest, like, industries, right? One of the biggest resources that built up the American empire, right? You have slavery. And these other natural resources extracted from the land down here. Now, we wanted to make a distinction too, right? So on this side, it's like the violence of settler colonialism and empire building. But here we have birds that are kind of migrating to the region. We didn't want to kind of like omit the fact that, you know, people have been migrating around the world for thousands of years, and there's nothing inherently wrong with traveling from one place in the world to another place in the world to try to make a better life for yourself and your family. What's wrong is when you come somewhere and then try to impose your ways on other people through violence, and try to like dominate and coerce others into like, you know, leaving. Or
I think too, what's really wrong about people just coming over to places that they're not from is the conditions that force them out of the place that they were in.
Exactly. A lot of people that are migrating are migrating because they're trying to escape their own oppressions, enslavement, like terrible conditions, right? So this one has chains around their legs, representing the many people that migrated to the New World or doing so to seek freedom, to under duress, etc. Right? So here you're bringing music, farming techniques. So we've got the chains representing like that, you know, trying to seek freedom. And there's this rich culture that comes out of that. So the mountains all over the world, and Appalachia is no exception, are places where people that want to be at a little bit at a distance from state power move to. People move to the mountains to be like a little bit further away from the nation state all over the world. And so, you know, in Appalachia, you had people that were traveling. You know, people came from Europe, you know, escaped slaves, found freedom in the mountains. And so you have these, like, interesting cultures that kind of blended. And down here we're celebrating that. You got the African gourd instruments. You got the Cherokee fluting and percussion. You got European ballads and string instruments. This is where bluegrass music comes from, this, like, really eclectic, you know, blending of culture and music. And so we wanted to honor that side of the history, too. Yeah.
I'm noticing kind of like a tree that mirrors it on the other side with like a wasp nest up here, but I can't quite see the...
Yeah, so these are paper wasps.
Yeah.
since we're kind of drawing ourselves into the gravity, we took shots at the wasps earlier. We're like, oh, you know, like, you know, the wasps are getting their act together, right? They're learning how to live, you know, efficiently, and they're putting some solar power and better insulation, and building more housing so that there's more, you know, so more people can join them in this collective kind of vision of the future. And so we have this, like, dense living to represent the fact that, like, the future isn't this, like, purely rural landscape, right? There's a lot of people on this planet. We can't all just go back to the rural landscape. A lot of people are going to be living in cities. We need to learn to live in cities in a sustainable and regenerative way. And so here are these paper wasps. Well, they're paper wasps, so they're a print collective. You can see, really, if you look closely, right, they're making zines, doing woodcuts and silk screening. They got their letterpress. They're pumping up their propaganda and their art. And they're using the most efficient form of solar and wind power that's ever been created, which is this clothesline right here.
That's something that excited me. You guys see a pawpaw right there?
Mm-hmm.
The flies are pollinating the flowers, which is how it goes.
Yeah, the pawpaw. Y'all know pawpaws? Anyone eat here? Eat pawpaws? Who likes pawpaw? Tell people why they should eat pawpaw.
It's delicious.
Where can you get pawpaw?
In Appalachians.
Yeah. Very hard to get it, like, to ship it far away, though. It's not a fruit that, like, that is easy to ship. They don't stay ripe for long, and so that's why it's not really commercially viable as a crop. So you don't really get, like, pawpaw being sold in supermarkets, but it's a really amazing food source in Appalachia. All right, I want to hear from some folks who haven't said anything yet. What captured your attention here? Yeah.
I like the little, like, library knowledge sharing corner over here, like, oral storytelling and communion together.
Yeah. Did you notice the map in there?
Yeah.
So one of the things I really like to point to is the dotted lines are representing, like, political boundaries, maybe, like, states or nations or counties. We can kind of, like, extrapolate. But the biggest, most dominant feature is the river shed, right? And so, the sign of the necessity of us kind of reimagining who our community is, right? Is our community who we have these political boundaries with, or is our community who we share water with, right? Waterways, right? And so, if we find a way to, like, protect our watershed in our political boundary, maybe over here, but, like, down here, they're polluting the shit out of it, well, that's not going to do that good, right? It's not going to create that much of a change. We need to be organized up and down our rivers in order to protect our water. And if you look closely, you'll see that there's, like, pollution in this water. The turtle is, like, testing the aquatic species, trying to figure out what's going on. This fish is popping out to tell the land animals what's going on and where the pollution's coming from. And so they're mapping it out, and they're doing power mapping in the community, too, to figure out, okay, how do we exert ourselves? How do we, like, who can we push? Who can we bring on side? You know, who are the key players that we need to mobilize around? So it's like a big organizing scene. It's also a shout out to, you know, this incredible organizing space in Appalachia, the Highlander Center. Are folks familiar with the Highlander Center at all? Do you want to say something about the Highlander Center?
I mean, I just know that a lot of people got, like, activist training there in Tennessee, is that right?
Just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yeah, like, people involved in the civil rights movement.
Yes. It's been around for a super long time. Yeah, definitely during the civil rights movement. And it's also a place where a lot of folks got training and organizing around environmental justice campaigns in the region, too.
What was the name of that again?
The Highlander. The Highlander Center. All right. Who else had their hands up? Yeah.
Who's that creature with the drum on the left?
Over here?
Yeah.
We got this bear over here. Storytelling around the fire. And here we're talking about, like, pre-colonial times, right? We're talking about folks coming together, you know, knowledge being passed down through the generations with storytelling. People are doing basket weaving. People are, you know, you've got different species, right? You got the snakes, you got the wolves, you got the turtles, and bats in there. And this is how people live for, like, tens of thousands of years, right? Like with the land, with each other, communally, in a circle, right? Yeah.
I'm curious about the section with like the go green, like
the wacky dude,
yeah,
and
the donate now, but, and like the dollar signs in the sky
being cut out. Yeah.
Does it feel better?
What do y'all think the dollar signs in the sky being cut out are representing?
Is it carbon credits?
Carbon credits, carbon trading, like carbon capitalism, right? All the pollution coming out of these smokestacks is turning into this like vortex of doom, this climate doom, this hurricane, these disasters that we're living through. It's also like right over the present, so it's kind of like we're in the eye of the storm right now.
Is it like greenwashing?
And then these
metaphors?
these two men, right, we're going to talk about them a little bit later on in the story, but yeah, it's talking about, the nonprofit industrial complex, talking about greenwashing, and talking about giving our agency to others, right? So it's this idea of like, you know, the professionalization of like activism, where we are meant to fund campaigns rather than be involved in them directly.
Mm-hmm.
We have a bigger critique and we'll get into it, but it's part of the rhyming story that I'm gonna go through in a minute here. Who else? I'm gonna take a few more from folks who haven't said anything yet.
There's a Red Cross and a Kaddush on, they look like they're hospitals and things that never got built because of commercialization,
over
maybe?
Here. Yeah, well here we're talking about like, you know, Walmarts and other big box stores moving into the region on these newly flattened mountaintops, right? So after they blow up the mountains, they might put a prison there. There's been a boom in like supermax prison construction in Appalachia. And then they're shipping prisoners from far away to Appalachia. It's one of like a new industry, bigger growing industries. Because it's like, oh, this new flattened land we can build these big things on, right? And so also they can sell those like newly flattened landscapes to like Walmarts and other strip malls, big box stores. So they'll often say, oh, we're creating jobs, right? Well, what kind of jobs? And what does that do to the broader economy? So this Walmart's coming in, bringing, you know, minimum wage, non-union jobs, and it's pushing these small businesses off the cliff. Right, these local, you know, local institutions that can't get the same prices because they don't have the same supply chain power that the Walmarts do, right? So you got the local pharmacy, the local grocery store, the local hardware store, right? That's all gonna be just kind of bulldozed by this new kind of capitalist push, corporate push into the region. Someone did mention, I think you mentioned the rabbit kind of like parachuting in. What do y'all see with this rabbit parachuting in? Who else is in this picture? What is that representing?
There's the guy with at the airport, the flashlight waving in. But the butterfly's kind of like fighting him or something.
That's interesting that you see that as a fight. So here we have like parachuting activist, right?
Okay.
He was like coming in to help fight these companies, these mining companies, right? Help protect the mountains. Maybe they just graduated college, right? They got their graduation cap on, right? So they don't have a family or a job yet to kind of take care of. They're pretty free to go and fuck shit up and, you know, start fights, you know, good fights. And the people, they're being called to do that, right? They're answering this phone call. You can see there's an exclamation point on there. It's an urgent call. It's like, yo, we need help, come to the front lines, right? But if you parachute into a community that you're not a part of, right, and you're not good at, like, taking direction or, like, getting involved on like in a coalition, you might just run in thinking you can be some hero and do some stuff that might not be the most strategic, right? And so that's why we have this other solidarity rabbit down here with the air traffic control ones, being like, hey, here's how you land in the community in a good way. We want your energy. We want to fight these companies together. But, you know, we're going to be stronger together. And, you know, we got to listen to the local community that we're a part of here, right? And so that's why they're listening to this local butterfly to help give those directions. And so we got that fast action of, you know, coming in and fighting. We also have that slow action. So we also have this turtle parachuting in. So you get the turtle and the rabbit, right? And the turtle's coming in to amplify the voices of the local organizers who are, you know, probably silenced in the local press, because the local press is taking, you know, advertising money from these industries, right? And so they need people from the outside to parachute in also to get their stories out to the rest of the country. And so shifting the narrative, right? Shifting the story, amplifying these other voices is also really important, but it's slow work. So fast and slow. All right, I'm going to take like one last one, and then I'm going to guide you through this piece with a rhyme. So someone who hasn't said anything yet, I want you to kick it off and tell me what element of this piece grabbed your attention.
I'm curious about the sound centipede.
Yeah. Yeah, who is that centipede? What do you think that centipede is up to? Is it a good centipede, bad centipede?
Probably bad.
Probably bad? Maybe good? I don't know. What does everyone else think? The centipede over here.
I don't know, the human rights lawyer or else a bureaucracy.
It looks like it's sending paper up into this big old machine up there.
Yeah, these paper airplanes, flying these paper airplanes at this machine, right? Digging through all the permits with a, you know, a fine-tooth comb and a magnifying glass, looking at the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the Surface Mine Community Reclamation Act. So try to figure out where some of these mining permits might be in violation of laws, right? Trying to do that paper fight, right? It's not the most glamorous, sexy job in our activist world, but it's such an important one. We want to give props where props are due, right? So not everybody can go to the front lines, not everybody can engage in different kinds of tactics and struggles, but this is an important thing that people can do, is let's go through the paper, you know, and then send in those hearing requests and those injunctions and whatever you can to try to slow these projects down. Maybe even stop some of these projects just with the paper, right? Most of the time, it doesn't go anywhere, right? Well, you can see most of these paper airplanes are getting shredded right up. But every now and then, one gets into the right into the gears and cracks them and slows them down, right? Maybe at least buying time for other folks to engage in other tactics, too. So celebrating the role of, like, the community researcher that's their contribution to the movement. Boring ass papers that no one else wants to read. Alright, that was the last one. So I'm just going to guide you through this piece now with a rhyming story. I'm going to stop for certain key historical moments, and then we can have a quick Q&A at the end of that. Then we'll take a short intermission, and then we're going to have Saku come in and present this piece here to you. So, check it out. I'm doing this rhyme because we've turned this piece into a rhyming story and published it as a kid's book. And ever since we did that, we've been getting invited into like middle schools, elementary schools, high schools, a lot more than we used to. We used to get a lot of invites into like universities and conferences, which we still do. But we're striving to make this more accessible to younger audiences and to like get more of our work into curriculum. So if you know teachers that might want to use this work, like it's all Creative Commons, and we do encourage folks to just take it and inject it into curriculums wherever there is the ability to do that. So check it out. Our story begins with the creation of coal in the ancient marshlands and the forests of old. The plants that lived there never got to decay. Instead, their carbon got buried away. The original peoples, they lived with the land. They took from it too, but they worked it by hand. This method did limit how much they could take, which worked out much better for everyone's sake. Then the colonists came, bringing their baggage. They brought disease too and did lots of damage. Treaties were signed by the Cherokee chiefs to keep land for their nation to live on in peace. And although the U.S. signed those treaties before, the settlers were greedy, they still wanted more. The treaties they tore, people's rights they ignored. Well, the Cherokee Phoenix would report and record. This salamander here is carrying a copy of the Cherokee Phoenix, a bilingual newspaper written in both English and Cherokee to spread resistance to forest removal, resistance to the Indian Removal Act and the Trail of Tears. The Cherokee language was an oral language up until this era, but a famous Cherokee man named Sequoia invented a syllabary with his daughter and spread that syllabary throughout the Cherokee Nation. Within a few months of this newspaper being distributed to Cherokee peoples, the Cherokee became the most literate people in all of Appalachia, as they were reading and writing about their own struggles to stay in their lands.
They petitioned, protested, and sued in the courts, but the U.S. president removed them by force. They walked through the winter with so little food. Many died on the journey. They cried as they moved. Here we're talking about the Trail of Tears. Y'all familiar with the Trail of Tears? Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to say something real quick about that?
Sucks.
Terrible. Absolutely terrible. One of the most genocidal acts, the Indian Removal Act was one of the most genocidal acts to ever be debated and voted on in Congress. It passed by only 5 votes. You can imagine how different this country might be if, like, a handful of people had voted the other way on that day. What it meant after Andrew Jackson signed it into law was that all indigenous peoples that lived to the east of the Mississippi River were going to be forced to move west to Oklahoma, which is going to become the new Indian country. So the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Seminole, Creek, other peoples were forced at gunpoint, at the onset of winter, represented by these snowflakes down here, onto a journey of hundreds, sometimes over 1,000 miles, And so walking through the winter, carrying their young, many died of starvation, many died of illnesses, many died of violence as they traveled through hostile territory. A third of the people died on this trail. Now, it's important to mention that not all Cherokee people were pushed out of Appalachia. There was Cherokee who hid in the mountains and reasserted themselves later and reestablished community. So there's still organized Cherokee community in Appalachia today. And there's many other Cherokee too that just assimilated as a way of survival, even ending up finding work in the mines eventually. Now it's important to note that even though there is Cherokee people and Cherokee community in Appalachia, there's 10 times more Cherokee people living today in Oklahoma, just the scale of the ethnic cleansing. And so even with the one third dying along the way, there's 10 times more people in Oklahoma than in Appalachia from the Cherokee. And the Cherokee nation in Appalachia, like the Cherokee community in North Carolina in particular, just got hit really hard with this hurricane as well. So I know we're hearing a lot about Asheville and other places, but Cherokee, North Carolina is also very, very, very hit by what just happened in the last few days. So their forests cut down, train tracks stretched for miles, coal, cotton, and lumber to make money piles. Wanting homes and employment, the settlers moved west and got trapped in the company towns with their debts. Workers weren't paid in money, just company scrip that they had to give back for their food and their rent. Enough was enough. The miners fought back. They picked up their guns and they launched an attack. They wore red bandanas. They shut down the mines. They went out on strike and they held picket lines. The government sided with bosses, of course, and sent in the army to use lethal force. So here we're talking about the Battle of Blair Mountain. By show of hands, how many people have never heard of Battle of Blair Mountain? A good half of the room, at least. How many people have heard about it but don't know that much about it? A bunch of y'all. How many people know a lot about the Battle of Blair Mountain and want to kind of just, like, pop off right now and talk about it a little bit? You want to go for it?
It was, man, it fucking sucked. You had the coal mines there who were just, I don't really know too much about the conditions. They weren't good, obviously, or no one would go on strike. I know that a bunch of people were getting evicted from their homes for union activity, and they started setting up these tent cities kind of nearby, and the bosses were not very nice about it, and kind of later on they started driving these trains by with guns mounted on them and would shoot into the camp cities. I think that the song "Which Side Are You On?" was written during one of these campaigns where the trains were shooting into the tent cities. It was fucked.
Do you want to add anything to that?
I went down to Matewan, West Virginia.
Oh, okay.
To the Mine Wars Museum.
You went to the Mine Wars
Museum?
Nice.
Incredible. I have a lot of stuff from that. I've been meaning to put a presentation together. I think what was said before covers a lot of it. What I remember was there was this incident, the Matewan Massacre, where it's kind of a gun battle that played out. And, like, the town really doesn't feel, it's not a lot there. You really, the history of what happened, the struggle, is, like, very much, like, you know, present. with everything in that town. And so, you know, that bullets from that battle between sort of supporters of the mine workers and, you know, company sort of citing gun thugs and police, the bullets are still in the walls in that place. And the other things I remember is like a plot, like I think the forces on the side of the mine owners dropped like something like a bomb on, you know, on the workers. And it was like 10,000 workers took up arms to defend themselves. And I remember one of the basic demands was like to be paid in American money.
Yeah.
Like one of the demands leading up to in the context of the mine wars.
Because they were being paid in company money, company scrip, right? So these company towns were like these kind of like feudal environments, right? You were like working for the company, but your boss was your landlord, and your landlord also ran the store, right? So you're trying to unionize, yeah, you're getting kicked out of town, you're getting evicted from the town, you're ending up in these 10 cities, right? And so the Battle of Blair Mountain was just one of many battles that took place over a decades long period known as the Coal Wars. There were coal wars throughout Appalachia, out in Colorado, up into Cape Breton in Canada, where the companies, the coal mining companies, literally went to war with their workers every time the workers demanded the right to unionize.
Sorry, there's just one more thing that I wanted to add that I think is a really important
Go
lesson to learn from the Battle of Blair Mountain. A lot of the people who were fighting fought in, I think, the First World War.
Yes.
And when the National Guard came in to kind of settle the dispute, a lot of the workers believed that the army was coming in to validate them and to they would be on their side, and kind of just handed over their guns without any fuss, and were extremely disappointed when the National Guard just told them to shut the fuck up. So I think that's a very important lesson to learn, that if you're in one of these kinds of engagements and the cops or the National Guard or whoever comes in, they're not your fucking friends.
Yeah. So this is the second largest armed insurrection in American history, second only to the U.S. Civil War, which I think they still teach about in schools. But they should teach about the Battle of Blair Mountain. That should be like part of every curriculum because it's such an important part of American history, not just labor history, but American history, period. And yeah, it's when over 10,000 coal mine workers took up arms, demanded the right to unionize after decades of being brutalized and beaten and even killed for trying to form unions in these company towns in Appalachia, in particular in West Virginia where this battle took place. The companies collaborated with the National Guard and the U.S. Marshals to go to war with these workers, as well as like private militias that they hired. They even hired planes and dropped bombs on these workers from the sky. It's the only example of workers on strike being bombed by plane in American history or in any Western nation's history. Didn't lead to immediate victories, as you mentioned. Like, the National Guard came in, and a lot of people were like, well, I just fought in World War I. They were still wearing their World War I uniforms in that fight, along with red bandanas around their necks, which is where the word redneck comes from. And so the victories weren't immediate, and a lot of people died, but these workers inspired worker rebellion across this whole continent and beyond, right? And so many other workers took up the struggle, and the long arc of history bends towards justice, so here we have some of these victories, right? Like the 8-hour work day, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours to be free, access to medicine, better health and safety conditions in the mines, even access to electricity. This light bulb is plugging in electricity to the party because, you know, for decades, the workers who mine the coal to power all the big industries and cities in America didn't have electricity themselves in their own communities until they stood up for it and fought for it through their unions. So here they are, you know, drinking their moonshine, dancing, singing their union anthems, right? Like, which side are you on? And I don't know if anyone reads musical notes, but this is Solidarity Forever. Songs that are, you know, were very ubiquitous at the time and are still sung on picket lines all throughout the world today. So the plight of the workers would soon get much better. They sang with their union, Solidarity Forever. Now as soon as things moved in the working man's favor, a monster appeared to replace most their labor. A continuous miner crushed coal in their lives. So the community as a whole had to get organized. They picketed and lobbied, even broke those machines. But at the movement's peak, got sold out by big greens. Rather than stopping the mechanization, those green groups just pushed for mere regulation.
Mountains got destroyed even more than before. And those miners, they couldn't find work anymore. Fast forward to the 1970s. Coal mining companies have figured it out. They don't have to go into the mountain to take the coal out. They could just blow the mountain up with dynamite and bring in these giant dragline machines that only take a few people to operate to scrape all the coal seams. And as this new kind of mining is just starting to get underway in Appalachia, you have this incredible and unlikely alliance emerge of coal mine workers, local environmentalists, farmers, faith communities, everyone coming together to say, hey, we don't agree on everything, but we can agree on this, because this is a lose. This means way less jobs for people in our community. It's going to have a devastating impact economically to Appalachia. This means way more pollution in our rivers. It means way more destruction of our mountains. It means whole communities are going to get pushed out of the way. You can't live in a mountain that doesn't exist. If you're mining inside the mountain, you can still be farming on the surface. You can still be living on the surface. If you're blowing the whole mountain up, everybody's got to go. Right? So they're trying to abolish this new kind of mining. They even have an abolition bill making its way through Congress at the time, and they're getting attention from across the country. Right? And so large environmental NGOs that weren't rooted in the community or accountable to local people in any way had meetings with the mining companies and pressured them to accept regulations on this new kind of mining. Once the companies agreed to some of those regulations that maybe addressed the tip of the iceberg of what was wrong with this whole scheme, the large environmental NGOs declared victory so loudly that they signaled to the rest of the country that the issue had been resolved, that we could all turn our attention to other issues and campaigns and regions, because this was a win, right? Leaving local people feeling very betrayed and sold out, because that's not what they were fighting for. They were trying to abolish this kind of mining. And that quick win that those environmental NGOs claimed, you know, it's a devastating loss when you look back, right? Like, hindsight is 2020. That was a devastating loss, because today over 500 mountains no longer exist. They've been blown up, flattened, they're gone, right? Can you imagine 500 mountains gone? And it's not just Appalachia. We take this piece on tour throughout Europe and, you know, Canada and Mexico and, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia, the Philippines. You know, almost everywhere we go, people say, yeah, we've got these here too now, right? This is more and more the dominant form of extraction. Explosives-based, strip mining, extreme extraction. Imagine if, you know, when it was first getting started in this region down here, it got abolished. How that might have changed things. The machines just got meaner and badder and bigger. The people got poorer and sadder and sicker. The coal fueled the wars and consumption and greed. The climate was changing to chaos with speed. But the rich just got richer. Coal smoke filled the skies. They made inside deals that would keep profits high. It was clear to the people who watched from below that they'd have to rise up and resist and say no. They passed out petitions. They signed with their paws. They held up the permits by studying laws. They tested the waters. The coal trucks they blacked. They made painted banners and rallied a lot. Some people resisted while others rebuilt. The local economy, the soil and the silt. They cleaned up the toxins with mushrooms and plants. Built kitchens and gardens, wrote music and danced. The fences came down. First peoples reclaimed the lands they've been missing, traditions and ways. All peoples united, the monster was dead. There's wind, sun, and currents that we use instead. Seas to be saved, rainwater to collect, and community was built around love and respect. The people in cities kept busy and buzzing, but now they were working together on something. They built housing, collectives, made better decisions, and figured out life without coal or emissions. We all have a role when we build from below. How will you help your community grow?
Spilt to feed, so animals fall, and almost fall. Deep.